Good evening. My name is Rebecca Fox, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the fact that we are gathered today in a place that lies within the traditional territory of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape, indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. On the behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary, the Departments of Environmental Studies and American Studies, the Food Studies Program, the First Year Seminar Program, and the Popol Shawl Center for Race and Ethnicity, I am pleased to welcome you to tonight's program, Cultural Politics of Taste, Mobility and Food Culture. What is a good taste? Would your answer change if I asked you what type of food is your favorite? Even if you're not able to narrow down your absolute favorites, we're all aware of our own internal hierarchy of tastes and the way we act on it. We can even begin trying to justify why we prefer some tastes over others. For example, if you grew up eating a lot of Italian food, you'll more than likely think of Italian food as a good taste. While the culture in which you grew up influences your tastes, the bigger community and population of an area has an even more significant influence on the hierarchy of good tastes. I grew up in the Hudson Valley, so I'm closely acquainted with the Culinary Institute of America. While going to their restaurants for a nice meal, my mother and I would stop by and watch through the windows of the classrooms to see what the chefs were doing. I grew up respecting the art of cooking when it was in a prestigious institution, but it took many years for me to have the same level of respect for the art of cooking in a random restaurant. I am pleased to have been given the opportunity to learn about this hierarchy of tastes and the biases we have with food in a greater depth than I could have imagined. Our speaker this evening, Krishnendu Ray, is currently chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at New York University. He is also a former professor and associate dean of liberal arts at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. Ray has researched this idea of good tastes and how food, especially in cities, contribute to a change in perspectives around cuisine and culture. He is author of the books The Ethnic Restaurateur, The Migrant's Table, and co-editor of Curried Cultures, Globalization, Food, and South Asia. In the Ethnic Restaurateur, Ray looks at the development of food culture, specifically in a city, and the ways in which immigrants contribute to the culinary landscape without recognition. Ray also expands on how the non-ethnic population influences the traditional cuisines of the ethnic other, and he has specifically analyzed this with Indian food, or the food we label as Indian. There will be a question and answer session immediately following the program, so please hold all questions until that time. The Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinions expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speaker, members of the Dickinson community, or audience members will not be tolerated. As a show of respect for our speaker and everyone in attendance, please stay until the end of the program, including the question and answer session. At this time, I ask that you please silence all cell phones and electronic devices. In the event of an emergency, please know that the handicapped accessible exits are located on the west side of this building. A book sale and signing will take place after the presentation. And now, please join me in welcoming our speaker, Krishnendu Ray.
Thank you, Rebecca. And thank you, Mark Aldridge, for inviting me to share my work with you. And thank you all for coming today. I was talking to Rebecca. The range of the Clark Forum's talks is really impressive. So I'm really honored to be here. And thank you for giving me this opportunity. So my work, in terms of the broadest frame, I'm going to show you some data today, and big and intimate. By intimate, I mean some ethnographic material, and then show some patterns, and then do some theorizing, which is I'm a bit of an inductive thinker. And what I'm going to do, spend about the first 10 minutes in framing my talk, then spend about 10 minutes in giving you an ethnographic vignette and then spend about 20 minutes talking about what Rebecca said was the hierarchy of taste. And I've done some recent data collection in Harrisburg just for you to talk about popularity and prestige of cuisines. I don't know about the city, so I'll depend on you to help me think with me. So with that, kind of in the broadest frame, I would say my work is about mobility and taste. And at the second level, it is also about theories of value and processes of evaluation, okay? And two aspects, which is one can be called materiality, the thing itself, in this case, food. What does it taste like? What does it smell like, et cetera? What does it sound like? Some of the food we like is because of the sound it makes, in fact. The other aspect of it is the sociality, which is, in fact, what makes food interesting is that all of us argue about it all the time. So there's a point to disputing taste. And specifically, I'm interested in the work of the work that cultural objects enable us to do when we compare, say, value art over craft, or buildings, the way we value or judge buildings for their aesthetic quality compared to movies, say music compared to graffiti, jazz compared to hip-hop. So specifically, I'm interested, as I said, in the popularity and prestige of cuisines, which I will develop in the last part of my talk. So my work is fundamentally about pleasure and social structure. And I know some of you are already reading books, for instance. In this particular case, it gives you two examples. Some of you I know are reading this book, Fresh Fruit and Broken Bodies, with Seth Holmes, which primary argument is about suffering and social structure, including physical suffering. How, in some ways, certain kinds of workers have to bear the burden of, in fact, the system literally on their bodies. My work is kind of the other half of it, other part of it, which is in this case, where I'm showing work on a space like a restaurant, and I want to talk a little about it today. I have worked on domestic cookery, on restaurants, and I'm in fact beginning work on street food. But to manage my material today, I'll exclusively focus on restaurants, partly because it is a shared space that, in fact, most of us have been to and we can talk about. So the great European contribution, especially French and Italian, has been to articulate the link between taste and territory in the name of terroir, okay, where we get basically highly developed notions of terroir in, say, wine consumption. The argument has mostly been about roots and rootedness. My argument is that covers about half of the human experience. The other half is movement, routes of dispersal, and billions of people are moving today and have moved in the past from country to city, from city to city, from nation to nation, along the littoral of the oceans, and from home to work and back again. So today I'm going to bring movement to the center of discussion on taste and the evaluative process by which things are argued over. So I think tastes travel, and they travel quite well. Obviously, in terms of produce, such as if you know even a bit of the history of potatoes or chilies, like the nation I come from, most people think Indian food would not work without green chilies, which, of course, is a New World cultivar. And in some ways, the relationship between that and tomatoes, of course, think about where Italian food would be without tomatoes, okay? And to think about the circulation of it. We can also, we see it very clearly when we think about our morning cup of tea or coffee, okay? The circulation of produce or even chocolate, okay? So tastes have traveled well, and my specific work is not on produce and not on the intoxicant or stimulants, but specifically on immigrant-designed food businesses in global cities. So that's the aspect of it. And In their cultural history, and I know some of you are already reading Massimo Montanari, for instance, and here's a quote from Alberto Capati and Massimo Montanari, the question, what is the glory of Dante compared to spaghetti? Okay, and they ask that, and they underline the point of contact between mundane practice and high art, where along they say, with the exchange of food products, there's also an exchange of documents and recipes. This lively traffic is vital for good taste. In fact, without realizing it, when we eat spaghetti, we also ingest something of Dante Alighieri. Okay, it is perfectly appropriate because I gather your next lead in terms of your food studies courses is going to be your Italian professor, so that we have a quote from Dante, a reference to Dante Alighieri's work and this relationship between Dante and spaghetti. So in their subtle attention to mundane materiality, by paying attention to pasta, receipts, cookbooks and utensils, Capati and Montanari gesture towards a subterranean possibility in Western aesthetic hierarchy. Aesthetics was born as a discursive field against the palatal taste in the 18th century, when it was argued that palatal taste is unconscious and too intimate to allow rational elaboration or serious disputation. There are, in fact, very good reasons to dispute taste. People do it all the time. And in fact, that is precisely what makes taste social. Okay? Such judgments are not, in fact, subjective, though it's commonplace to say, but that's subjective. You like one thing, and you like vanilla, and I like chocolate. But in some ways, a lot of the discussion is about, for instance, different kinds of vanilla and what kind of vanilla you like and the disputation around it. So in fact, a lot of the claims there are really not subjective, but in fact, intersubjective. No different from how facts are established, in fact, in the sciences and especially the social sciences. So today I'm going to look, I'm going to introduce two colorful characters in terms of the ethnographic material. But before I do that, I do want to kind of show you a couple of the framing of the immigrants in the contemporary American food system. Oh, by the way, if you need, for instance, you can take notes if you need to, but you can also just send me an email and I'll send this to you. And you can also probably get a copy of this right from here. So think about it as immigrants, in fact, today numerically dominate the American food system. There are only, in fact, about 2 million farms in the United States, and there are about 2 million farm workers, other than, of course, household people who belong to the household. And almost all of the farm workers are foreign-born in the United States today. So there's a good reason why study immigrants and the American food system. The other part of it is where most of my work is happening is in restaurant kitchens, okay? And I'll, in fact, ask you a question to guess as to how many restaurants there are in the United States. But there are about 15 million people, in fact, work in restaurants, and many of them are foreign-born. So, in fact, when I started this project, the question that really intrigued me was, okay, if I go to a restaurant today and I, in fact, look behind in the kitchen, I talk to the owner, I talk to the server, I talk to the busser, there's very clear sense that foreign-born are numerous. How far back does this pattern go? So that was one of my first empirical questions about this material when I started work. And I'm just going to give you one example. This is on the eve of the Civil War, okay? And of course, this is coming from the census. And how often do we take census data in the United States? Excellent. Every 10 years. So we have census data. In this case, we needed two data points, occupation and birthplace, Okay? And that the first time we collected that was in the 1850 census. This is just on the eve of the Civil War. And I want to show you this to kind of disabuse us of this idea that the immigrants play an important role in the food system is only a recent phenomena. This is, in fact, ubiquitous. This is 1860. And look at a couple of things. So the blue is the U.S. data. And my work primarily has been in New York City. So that's red. As you can see, occupations such as hotel keepers, restaurant keepers, bakers, by the way, these were census categories, hotel keepers, restaurant keepers, bakers, brewers, butchers are in fact predominantly or overwhelmingly foreign-born. Almost every baker in New York City was foreign-born through successive census data collection. Then you see on the other side, you see contrast language-dependent occupations just highlighted in yellow there. Lawyers and teachers are, in fact, predominantly native-born, okay? They're context-specific, and they're especially language-dependent one. Also note the occupations that are missing. I was, in fact, looking for cooks, and I couldn't find cooks in this data because no one was counting cooks separately. Because most cooks were counted under the category servants at home, okay? And in fact, cooks were not counted as a public occupation until the 1910 census. That also tells you what's happening with the household and the labor force in the household, okay? And by the way, no one was yet counting chefs, not in 1910. Chefs started getting counted only in, when do you think? 56, excellent. Who said 1980s? It's the 1980 census. The chefs get counted. It's a very recent occupation. So in a sense, what's interesting here is, that's the funny thing about research. You go seeking something, you don't find it, you find other things. Okay? And so the missing data here, in fact, gives you a glimpse of a social history of an occupation. Okay, with its ubiquity and classificatory location as a working class occupation or a profession. That in itself is a fascinating story, in fact, how occupations are born. And by the way, they also die. All occupations are born and all occupations eventually die if we wait long enough for them. Okay, and so for instance, the fate of, say, modern physicians, okay, is almost the reverse of the fate of pastors, okay, in terms of numbers and in terms of income and in terms of prestige. So occupational data is absolutely a fascinating data. Now, the next thing, and this is where I'm going to get a little deeper into the restaurant space that I'm specifically talking about. By the way, how many restaurants do you think in the United States? By now, you should have enough time to Google it. About? Approximately? 2 million. Good guess. It's a little under a million. And right now, latest is this number. This number changes depending on when it is being counted and the year it is being counted. Okay? And out of this, what I'm interested in, by the way, how many, say, McDonald's? McDonald's are included in this. How many McDonald's are there in the U.S.? About. I'm interested in these numbers, A, just because I'm nitpicky, but also because a sense of proportion, a ratio about it. There are about 14,000 McDonald's, okay? And so you can see the numbers there. Now, compared to McDonald's, I'm interested, remember, in ethno-national markers, okay? What is the most popular kind of restaurants in the United States, you would think? One is these fast food places, which presumably don't have ethno-national markers, okay? What is the most popular category of restaurants in the United States, if you were to make a guess? Excellent. Italian. So, and look at the number there. There are about 100,000 Italian restaurants. By the way, they are rounded to 100,000 here to 1,000 because the number is a little squishy because the government is not collecting data because they're not interested in whether you're selling Italian or Chinese food as long as you're paying taxes. Okay? So about 100,000 and about 16 million people of that heritage. Okay? And we will come back to the Italian case repeatedly. It's a very interesting category of people and food, and the number of people here, 16 million, most link back to an ancestry that came to the United States between 1880 and 1924. And I'll talk about it. What is the most popular one after this, you think? after Italian. Chinese, pretty close. No, you're correct, in fact. Yes. In fact, the Chinese number is going to move down to the next category, and you will see Chinese restaurants. So here's the thing. I think Americans eat more Chinese food than fast food, as in McDonald's, Burger King. So I think Americans have a very strong preference for Chinese food. Look at the number of people, 5 million people. Okay, 50,000, 5 million. And the next is? Excellent, very good, intuitive sense, which is about 45,000. It is getting close to 50,000. And look at the number of people of that heritage in the U.S., 35 million. So the first thing you see is there is no one-to-one relationship between population and popularity of a cuisine, and we'll come back to it. If these are the most obvious ones, and there are also restaurants that are missing. Okay? If we just go by ethnicity of people, there should be more German-American restaurants than any other restaurants in the United States. Okay? And we'll talk a little about it, which is a very interesting case. And by the way, they come to dominate the beer and wine industry, which itself is very interesting, where basically Anglo-Protestants stay away from a lot of the alcohol business. Okay? And the next one, for no good reason, is Indian, just because I look like that. So that's their data there, okay? And if you look at that, look at the Indian data and look at the Chinese data. 50,000 restaurants, 5 million people, 4,000 restaurants, 4 million people, which tells you there's a complicated relationship about something about population, people. And in fact, what we also see is that some ethnicities vanish from view over time and new ethnicities come into play. Keep that in mind. And I said the other point is population and popularity are not directly related. Though there is some relationship between them. This is the ethnographic part. I want to immerse you in a particular place. Okay, now I've looked at, until now I've looked at very thin, high-level data, kind of the bird's eye view. Okay, digging in a little, salt and pepper sits at the dense intersection of a cross street and an avenue at the lower end of Manhattan. Caught in a whirl of honking buses spewing fumes, parked cars, and a small delivery truck with graffiti covering its thin, white skin. On the sidewalk, a ginkgo sapling struggles to reach the sunlight under the shadow of a three-story walk-up. A crush of pedestrians weave their way to and from the subway station, and much of this is good thing for Muhammad Rasool. It brings the customer stumbling across the threshold of salt and pepper. I know some of you have read the book, so some of this should sound a little familiar, and I want you to ask the most brilliant questions at the end of this, okay? And this restaurant has this kind of narrow space on a sidewalk, and the long, narrow space smells of cumin and garam masala with the sweet, hot hint of clove and cinnamon. The steam table is on the left, behind a glass sneeze guard with its row of 12 cooked items ready to be ladled onto plates. Salt and pepper belongs to the lower end of the universe of Indian restaurants in Manhattan. Although we do not have access to the check averages, we can find a surrogate in the average price of an entree, which is about $11 for the nearly 400 Indian restaurants in Manhattan. There are 12 Indian restaurants in Manhattan with entrees under $6, which is salt and pepper's threshold. So it's at the bottom end of the pile. The most expensive Indian restaurants in Manhattan, and if you get a chance to go to Manhattan, you should try and eat there and tell me how good or bad it is, such as Junoon and Indian Accent, have entrees a little over $20, although some go above $30, such as the rack of lamb cooked in the tandoor. Okay, so I asked Muhammad Rasool, how did you get into the restaurant business in the first place? He says, you see, I came to this country, I did odd jobs, worked in a gas station for a couple of months. I'd been driving a yellow cab for 6 to 7 months. That is when I ate at a restaurant on 42nd Street. It was very crowded and people were rude. That is where I got the idea that I should have a restaurant and do a better job at it. I drove taxi for 9 more months, saved some money. I continued to drive taxi at night to pay my workers. So what appears as an isolated decision-making on the part of Rasul is the mere artifact of an interview process, us talking, okay? Over the length of the whole interaction, it is clear that many of his decisions are deeply embedded in social relations with co-ethnics. In the evenings, for instance, when he heads back to Queens, he often stops by at a friend's business and over a couple of cups of tea, looks over Pakistani and diasporic newspapers. Dinner is prepared by his wife. They typically watch TV, catch a Bollywood movie, call family late into the night, because remember, that's next day in India and Pakistan, before retiring and back to work in Manhattan in the morning. So I asked him, how do you characterize your restaurant? He says, fast food restaurant, Indian, Pakistani, spicy food. I also carry less spicy Spanish-American food. I said, Spanish-American. Yes, because you see, we have rice and we have beans and chicken, of course, everyone eats. It is the same food without spices that is Spanish food. This is, of course, an immigrant's understanding of a host society, right? And so we find Rasul kind of reorienting himself to this very specific Latinx public and that street corner as fewer and fewer South Asian taxi drivers, in fact, stop by his place. Although if you have visited New York City, you would know that almost 80% of New York City's approximately 13,000 licensed yellow cab drivers are South Asians. That is a very interesting story how that happens. So every street corner in the city has its character. This one is too busy to allow cabbies to stop long enough, precisely the thing that gets Muhammad Rasul all the foot traffic. One day the conversation drifted to cooking. Do you cook at home? Muhammad Rasul says, nope. Where did you learn how to cook? It's easy, I know it. Did you train for it? Nope. You just know it? Yes, it does not take a genius, you know. Who cooks at home? My wife. Did your wife give you the recipes? Nope. Do you consult cookbooks? Nope. Did you watch your wife cook? Nope. So I was at my wit's end as to, so what's going on? How is he picking it up? Okay. He says, no, but she doesn't tell me how to cook, but she gives me confidence. She didn't tell me how to cook. If you don't know how to cook, when your partners can take advantage of you. Once I called my wife on the phone and asked her how to make alu gobi, and she told me how to do it. Then I did it. I asked her, how do I cook this? How do I cook that? She tells me, I do it. It does not take a genius, you know. You see this Mexican guy who works for me now? He learned just watching me. Now he's my best cook. And then Muhammad Rasul ends this discussion by saying, it is just business. It is business. People come in, they take a look at it, and think it must take all these people to make complicated things. But it is simple. It is business. It is just business. So there are a number of things to note here. First, the failure of the interview as a tool to elicit tacit knowledge about cooking. Okay? Very difficult to talk about sewing and cooking, okay? And you are startled by, in fact, the question, how do you know something? Okay? Second, the phrase, it is business, it is just business, is a complex cryptic opening into differing values in differing domains. It implicates necessity for a soul, but not essence, which he constructs in opposition to what else he does. So in an ethnographer, Paul Stoller's work, that is precisely what allowed the Nigerian vendor Elhaj Haruni Sule to explain away contradictions between a moral worldview and some of the dirty everyday activity with the words, money has no smell. The analog is Rasul's, it is business, it is just business, which allows him, in fact, some ethical and aesthetic leeway, some elbow room to work in this world. So when Rasul was asked, do you look at online reviews of your restaurant? He provided a desultory response. It was clear that he was unable or unwilling to play in the gastronomic world of Manhattan, which is very different from the position of another entrepreneur who I want to bring in right now as the other character in this story. This other entrepreneur is Chitrita Mukherjee. She's a 34-year-old comfortably Anglophone Indian immigrant born in Kolkata. She suggested the cosmopolitan identifier South Asian rather than the narrower Indian when I asked her about her ethnic self-identification. Her handiwork garnered substantial critical attention in the world of gastronomic discourse as a sleek sandwich shop that specializes in upmarket spins on Bombay-style street food with a focus on pow, which are meat and vegetable samis served on sliders on ghee-girdled buns. Okay, so that's what kind of they look like. So I asked her, what brought you to the concept? She said, I was attracted by the Parsons School program in lighting. I got my master's in lighting design. I became fascinated by the food scene here. We thought Indian food has this market gap where you could find very expensive good Indian food or two-day-old curries. We wanted fresh Indian food, which would be portable, sold at a value to students and young professionals, to people like us. So I asked her, you're Bengali, so why not a Kolkata concept? Okay, she says, I don't think the repertoire of Kolkata street food is large enough to provide us with a range. You have kati roll, which we have, jhalmuri, puchka. I'll explain these things later if you're interested. The Bombay repertoire both works better and is underserved. For instance, a Delhi concept would work with parathas and kebabs, but she says no one does vada pav. Only two or three places do it in Queens, but they don't do it right. Plus, a slider works as a good translation of pav. I tell her, I was surprised by the name vada pav because it is so local and specific. Weren't you afraid that it might not make any sense to your American audience? Says, yes, I worry about it. My fallback position is that I can always go back to lighting design if the concept fails, she said, laughing. You said you cook at home. How did you learn to cook? I come from a joint family. Sunday would be a day when everybody cooked something. It was very competitive, and an uncle had studied in a hotel management degree, gotten a hotel management degree, but did not pursue a career in it. So, yes, every time we made a dish, he challenged us to break it down and analyze it. So these two characters, Muhammad Rasool and Chitrita Mukherjee, have designed their restaurants in Manhattan within the constraints of their material, symbolic, and bodily resources of skill and imagination. One started with $35,000 investment, a bachelor's degree from Pakistan, and the limits of his Punjabi-Pakistani masculine habitus. He didn't know how to cook. Now he doesn't want to cook. For clearly for him, that is women's work, servants' labor. That is gesturing towards the context of South Asia. Since he does not cook, his menu and recipes are drifting more and more towards the habits of his so-called Mexican cook, and their joint understanding of American habits, specified by his audience of sidewalk vendors and commuters. With less capital and less embodied skill, Rasool's transaction with his customers have to concede a lot more ground than Mukherjee's, but he can fulfill their needs for nourishment with his posture towards commerce. Remember his thing about this is just business or is this culture. She's also more successful at translating the pow as a slider, which is a product of her greater familiarity with Anglophone American popular culture. What I initially presumed to be Mukherjee's advantage, which is cool, innovative, and more expensive cooking, turned out to be her precise disadvantage. Salt and pepper is still open, and vada pav has shut down. Her customers did not care enough for her designer Indian food. The price they were willing to pay for it was much lower than French or Italian or Japanese cuisine. And that hierarchy of taste needs a broader and a longer historical frame to be explained, and that is what I do in the next section. So I step out from that material to look at this larger pattern and say, so what has been the history? What does it look like in a cross-section, and how has it changed historically? So in this section, called Hierarchy of Taste, I'll first give you the argument, and then I'll give you the data, which, of course, my work was really the inverse. In some ways, this is the method of explication and the method of research are almost the inverse of it. Only after doing the research do you know, figure out what your argument is going to be. But at first, I'm going to give you the argument, and then so that you can understand the data that comes. So American tastemakers, that is journalists, restaurant critics, and professional chefs, frame their appropriation of 20th century culinary cultures in two divergent ways. My work is mostly in the 20th century, though I get a little into the 19th, and you will see I'll end with the 21st. First, as high-status foreign foods, initially limited to continental. Those of us who are old enough will remember continental, which is dying right now, in fact, and French cuisines, eventually, in fact, consecrating Italian and Japanese cuisine at the end of the 20th century. Second, as the low-status product of the labor and implicit knowledge of the immigrant poor classified as ethnic fare. The appropriation of the first sort is understood primarily in aesthetic terms of taste and notions of skill, while the latter is understood as a matter of necessity, primarily in terms of undifferentiated toil and authenticity. So there's a long-term pattern of ethnic succession here. Food work done by German and Irish, by the way, you saw that graph from 1860, almost all of the bakers and butchers were either German or Irish. Okay, immigrants in the mid-19th century, which eventually would become, say, Italians and Eastern Europeans, often Eastern Europeans, Jews, at the end of the 19th century, out of which we get bagel and lox, etc., who in turn were replaced by Latinos and Asians at the end of the 20th century. That mostly takes off, mostly after 1965, but acutely after, in fact, 1985. Tastes have changed, too. French cuisine gave way to New American, Japanese, and Italian cuisine in America's most expensive restaurants, which were accented by Asian and Latin American ingredients at the end of the last century. So to give you a broad sense of it, there's a twofold ethnic succession. Think about on one end the ethnicity of the labor force, and the other end the ethnicity of the food served. And they have a complex relationship to each other, not a one-to-one relationship. So let me show you some data over the last generation. I'm going to start with longitudinal data over the last 30 years, and then I'm going to do some cross-sectional data a more recent time. So what we have here is one representation of, this is from Zagat. Here I use the price for a meal for one. For the last 30 years, this is 1986 to 2016. Zagat started in 1979, but none of its data is publicly available until you get the Library of Congress as the first collection of Zagat as ephemera in 1986. So I could only go back to 1986, and Zagat was not interested in sharing data with me because they didn't know what kind of a story I was going to tell. And there are lots of kind of limitations of this data, but I want to draw your attention to a couple of things. Look at the right-hand side of it, your right-hand side, and you see rank in 2016, and you have those named up there. Looking at the top line over the last 30 years, French has been doing very well at the high end, predictably, though wobbling a bit, as you can see. So I'm waiting for the 2020 data to come out, and I'm going to add that to that purple line you see. What is radical here is the rise of Japanese, okay, which is the light green line. It is radical for two reasons. It is the first non-European cuisine to break through the ceiling. Secondly, in some markets, it is in fact the most expensive food, matched perhaps only very recently by Nordic, but Nordic is very thin in popularity and will probably fade soon after René Redzepi's great kind of a stardom in the world. There are a couple of things that are not surprising about the rise of Japanese. That's my argument here. Its marriage to haute French cuisine through the mediation of the French chef Paul Bocuse, the father of the most influential nouvelle French cuisine, especially in terms of plate presentation. Remember the joke about haute cuisine, that haute cuisine costs a lot of money for very little food? Okay, that is very, very Paul Bocuse with the use of Japanese aesthetics, especially use of empty space on a plate. Okay? And you can see that that is often marks, in fact, high-end cuisine from mid-market to low-end cuisine. Second, this gestures towards an old French fascination since Impressionism with Japanese watercolors on silk and paper. There's a long tradition, in fact, in France from the end of the 19th century, which is fascinated with Japanese watercolors and especially the quality of light. You can see that in a lot of French Impressionist paintings. Finally, it's linked to the rise of Japan, and this is my argument, as a major economic power. In fact, with a 20-year lag, its rise also as a soft power. That is another aspect of my story, which is the relationship between capital, military power, and soft power. Again, it's not one-to-one, but there's an interesting relationship. Japanese prestige, in fact, has peaked and, in fact, is flattening out. I'll show you some data, Yelp data, which is in some ways more leading edge than Zagat about it. Other things to note about the visual, the slight decline of price by Italian, that's the red one, primarily, in fact, not because of decline of prestige of Italian, but the rise of pizza places. Okay? And so if I separate the data between pizza and Italian, then, in fact, the Italian climbs much more steeply in terms of rank, and I'll talk about it. The dramatic rise of Greek and Korean, by the way, which you will see in this next one, the top two, the rate of increase, in fact, is fastest now for Greek and Korean. Okay, in New York City, it'll be slightly different in different cities. I'll talk about it. And what I've also highlighted here is the Japanese and Chinese, the one in dark blue, because I want to kind of make this argument that, in fact, it is not simply a question of race. It is, in fact, the question of race multiplied with class, multiplied with national soft power, which is a very interesting one. It's a complicated category. Now, the next one I want to provide, this is a cross-sectional data from Yelp, and I just want to highlight a couple of things. What you see on the y-axis is the popularity, declining popularity. So the most popular are Italian, Chinese, Mexican, Seoul, etc. And the look at the data marked in green on the right side. Okay, that is the pricey restaurant as a percentage in that category of restaurant, which I use as a surrogate for prestige, as a stand-in. Okay, so what you see in some ways is the top ones there are predictably French, which is 27% of French restaurants in New York City are upscale, are pricey. Okay, compared to, say, for instance, up there are New American 24. By the way, if you call a restaurant New American, your prices are higher than if you call a restaurant American. Okay, so in some ways, classifications have consequences. It's a very Pierre Bourdieu argument. Okay, and so what is surprising there, you have Israeli down there 14%, Southern out there. Look at the other side of it. Low-prestige foods tend to be mostly, in this case, still Chinese, Thai, Indian, Arab, all at about 2%. Only 2% of Arab restaurants and Indian restaurants and Thai restaurants in New York City are expensive. Okay? By the way, if you compare food in Arab and Israeli restaurants, you will find that they sell more or less the same food. But the difference is the Israeli restaurants can sell food from the Eastern Mediterranean, such as hummus and salads and baba ganoush, at almost 150% higher prices to restaurants that are called Arab restaurants. Okay? That's what I mean exactly by a hierarchy of taste. Okay? And the Israeli chefs are often going to be named, while the Arab chefs are not going to be named. So, and especially with global superstars like Otto Lengi, for instance, Israeli cuisine is really having its day in the global gastronomic discourse. That is the crucial distinction between haute cuisine and ethnic cuisine. And just for comparison's sake, before I get to the Harrisburg data, I just want to show you the LA data. You saw the New York one, and this is the LA data from Yelp. Compared to New York City, you can see predictably that Mexican food is more popular in LA. Okay? Yet, Italian, Chinese, and Mexican are still the top three. okay, which is in fact a national pattern. I have covered about 25 cities, and the data persistently shows that, which you already know from the total number of restaurants nationally anyway. Okay, this data is confirming that data. Okay, surprisingly, there are fewer upscale Mexican restaurants in LA than New York City. That surprised me. Okay, but people say, my LA friends say, LA Mexican restaurants are known a lot more for their street foods and tacos rather than the upscale. The difference is 3% to 6%. In LA, only 3% of Mexican restaurants are upscale. While 27% of French restaurants in New York City are upscale, only 9% of French restaurants are upscale in LA. So in a sense, LA, the traditional hierarchy of taste, has in fact decayed the most dramatically amongst American cities. Okay, so to save time, I'm not going to show you data on San Francisco, but trust me on that for instance, Greek and Korean perform much more poorly in San Francisco than in New York City or LA. It's a very East Coast phenomena in some ways, the Greek phenomena, and the Korean, Mexican food truck phenomena is a very LA phenomena. It's not, so there are regional differences about it. Now, to your neighborhood. I expanded the data to collect even pizza places. So here is the list in terms of popularity. I included pizza places, steakhouses, seafood. So here you have ethno-national markers and any other kind of markers. So you have the popularity going down, okay? And you have the prestige on the right side in terms of the orange data. Okay, so you still have the top three in terms of popularity, which is Italian, including pizza places here. Mexican, including taco places. Whereas, surprisingly to me, a lot more sushi and southern are more popular than Chinese. That is quite different from many of the, at least the East Coast cities that I have looked at closely, and the West Coast cities. Predictably, the prestige, and this is the orange data, of French, Israeli, Peruvian, and steakhouses are high and comparable, in fact, nationally. Prestige of Greek and Indian is much lower than East Coast markets, but comparable to Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Just to compare the Harrisburg data, I also did it with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. I don't want to show that to you here. But I do want to historicize some of this material. Let me look at, okay. There are a couple of things I want to take a case. So you have looked at very cross-sectional data now. Well, I want to change to one thing. Remember, I was interested in one of these questions, the missing folks, okay? So German restaurants, maybe I'll give you one or two examples about how historically things change. And this is a New York Times journalists writing about German restaurant in 1873. They serve the odd things that foreigners love, along with roasts, pumpkin pies, and dumplings that Americans prefer. For the Frenchmen, there is lentil soup in which masses of bologna sausage are floating, while the Irishman is vigorously to work on something like fish balls smothered in red cabbage, all of which is served with an enormous supply of coarse German bread. One customer orders a Wiener Schnitzel, a tremendous name, which, however, when brought, is only veal cutlet with the bone removed. All this, by the way, for 15 cents. Okay? So this thing about cheapness. Further investigation into the mysteries of German cuisine shows beef a la mode served with macaroni, a very peculiar but highly satisfactory way of eating it, all served by waiters who are clearly German. I don't know about you. I can't figure out a clearly German guy from other white guys, but this guy can figure out a clearly German guy, which may be habitus, in fact, kind of a bodily hexis that is visible. And so this mix, this thing of inviting exoticism is playing out in the case of the Germans. In fact, Anglos would complain a lot about, in fact, German food, especially German beer gardens, which are where, in fact, women and children are also drinking, okay? And that was a scandal for the Anglo pub-going group which wanted it gendered and generational in a particular way. So a lot of the complaint is about that. And when you take the German data, and again, just a quick idea of it, this is just the talk, calculating talk, I'm counting it, and German comes very close to the bottom of it in terms of the 170-year run of places. This is New York Times. If I do the same with the Chicago Tribune, which I did, the German shows up a little higher, okay, because of the area of settlement. But it's still relatively, a lot of is missing data. I want to show this. Just one thing I want to draw your attention to. You just look at the German data point. This is, say, 1881 to about 2013 when I calculated the data. And I just wanted you to look at the German one. You see the catastrophic decline. Okay, between, let's say, about 1910 to about 1940. Okay? And that's fascinating. It has never happened so catastrophically to any group that conversation about it has been kind of, in some ways, suppressed. Okay? What do you think might have happened? Wars, right? Especially before this data collection, I didn't realize the important role the First World War played in the suppressing of German ethnicity. Okay? German was the most important second language taught in American schools. Okay? They got thrown out of schools right away on the eve and during the First World War. And a lot of the German food in some ways, and in fact names, got hidden under Anglo names. So Müller becomes Miller. Okay, and so some of these changes are happening, and this was kind of fascinating in terms of how different groups, and you see this with naming, of course, and the second one I want to draw your attention to is the Italian group, and maybe I'll end with that. The Italian example is a fascinating example because today we think very highly, outsiders think highly of Italian food. But in the 1880s, it has been argued that Italian food is too unhealthy and too garlicky, and nutritionists are arguing against it. And of course, thankfully, the Italians don't listen to any of this complaint about their food. They continue to eat their very good food. They are being associated with wine and olive oil that is looked at with great disdain. Okay, and remember, this is also the moment of prohibition. And this is James Beard, the great guru of American cuisine, who says his judgment of Italian cookery is not too high, and the whole thing flips. This is the Food Network and how we have gone to the other side with delicious flavors, etc. So what I want to say is this. Our opinions about the same cuisine changes quite dramatically over time, which might have very little to do with food rather than, in fact, the class of people. That's my hypothesis. And I want to specify it a little more. This is, by the way, a New Yorker cartoon. Broccoli Rob gets introduced to the American audience by the Italians. Okay, this is about a girl complaining. She thinks broccoli is just another spinach. Okay, it is new in this particular case. I want to draw your attention to kind of one thing, that Italian food, in fact, falls and rises compared to the class of people who are coming in. And I want to draw your attention to two data points. One is this bottom one on the left, which is the entry of new southern Italian immigrants between 1880 and 1924. That is when a lot of this complaining is going on about Italian food. Before that, by the way, Thomas Jefferson had talked very highly of macaroni and cheese. It is served in high-end restaurants, in American cities. And then by about 1900, in fact, there's a beautiful example of Pinocchio's author, okay, Carlo Lorenzini, talking about Sicilian pizza in 1886. And it's nicely encapsulate this relationship. He says, the blackened aspect of the toasted crust, the whitish sheen of garlic and anchovy, the greenish-yellow tint of the oil and fried herbs, and those red bits of tomato here and there give pizza the appearance of complicated filth that matches the dirt of the vendor. Okay? So right there, I rest my case about class and taste and group of people. And you can see that, by the way, this is about sushi. New Yorker has this cartoons telling people how to eat sushi, etc. A couple of things I've said here to close it. So popularity and prestige of cuisines are not randomized. They exhibit patterns. There's a hierarchy of taste, and that taste hierarchy changes over time. Some, such as German and Irish, are hidden in plain view and partly suppressed, and the Irish case, in fact, makes it more complicated, where you can see it, the kind of the range of Northern European cuisine. The hierarchy is different in different cities, yet there are some national and some regional patterns. And I conclude by saying, I think we are on the cusp of expensive Chinese food. If you have caught the drift of my argument, you can predict my reason for it, which is we are on the cusp of the end of poor Chinese in-migration. If you're running a Chinese restaurant today, one of your biggest problems is getting Chinese labor. Increasingly, most Chinese restaurants, in fact, are worked by Central American labor. Okay, and the rise of power of Chinese economy and prestige, which is about soft power, especially if the economy continues to grow. So my larger judgment here is that conversations about good taste sometimes have very little to do with the food and a lot to do with our judgments about the class and color of the people. Okay, and so to kind of, maybe I'll stop there with this kind of beautiful quote that I have from Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz to a powerful bishop. If you have been wondering, why do I talk so much about cooking and cleaning? She says, if Aristotle had cooked, he would have written a great deal more. So disputing taste can be, in fact, a productive enterprise. Thank you. Get some comments and questions. Yep.
We'll now begin the question and answer session. Since the event is being recorded and live streamed, please raise your hand and wait for the mic to reach you before asking your question. As an undergraduate institution, we will prioritize students' questions, and we might also hear from our online viewers. We'll now take the first question.
Thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. So you talked about Arab and Israeli cuisine and why Israeli cuisine is considered more prestigious than Arabic cuisine, like in general. Would you say that as the specificity of the cuisine being presented increases, the prestige also increases?
What is the second part of it?
The prestige also increases?
So, excellent point. In fact, there's a relationship to the more specific the cuisine gets in terms of techniques and ingredients and provenance of it, it is generally associated. So, for instance, with French, we can figure out Provençal cuisine. With Italian, for instance, especially with Italian, regional cuisine, food from Sicily and food from the Piedmont, very different. And Italians, of course, know how to make that distinctions. But Americans also are learning how to make that distinction. For instance, compared to, say, Indian food. In fact, what we call Indian food is Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi food. And that is, calling something Indian food is like saying calling something European food. So it's like from Poland to Sicily. And remember, this is 24 national languages, not dialects, languages with different scripts. So my argument is wherever there's a language, there's going to be a cuisine, but we cannot see it from very far, okay, if you're not exposed to the kind of the differences. So in fact, there is a relationship between popularity and prestige, which is people have to become familiar with the cuisine to be able to make distinctions. And there's a demand side question, okay, what we are expecting Indian food to be, and there's also a supply side question, which is why are Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis keep giving us chicken tikka masala and tandoori chicken, and not, for instance, the various regional cuisines of India. So there's a demand side and a supply side. Excellent point. Our capacity to make finer distinctions is, in fact, the sign of a prestige of a cuisine. most clearly articulated in our capacity to make distinctions amongst wines, which to my mother is just a bunch of rotten grapes.
I was just wondering if you've looked at, like, you've looked at a lot of, like, the broader, like, cities and nationwide trends, but if you've looked at, like, institutional trends, and I'm thinking of, like, Grand Central, where, you know, the first floor is, like, Cipriani, and the Oyster Bar in the basement is, like, ethnic cuisines.
Good.
And if you looked at that really micro level.
Lovely. You should write that book. That's fantastic. That's a beautiful argument about, in some ways, some of my big data, of course, that's always the problem with big data. It's not intimate enough, you know? It doesn't get specific enough, okay? So it gives you some ratios about it, okay? And look at lots of things I'm missing here. And this is a very construction of taste, which I would say is, let me just give one example of it, is... I'll come back to it. It foregrounds immigrant foods, and in fact, I can get to it. It foregrounds immigrant food, but in fact pushes to the background. One of the things that happens is, for instance, African-American contributions go totally out of view. Native American contributions go out of view. This is totally in the construct of this idea of immigration and food, and I know the limitations of it, and the limitations is the structure of partly the limitations of my expertise. So I'll give you an example. There are 100,000 cookbooks in the United States, about 100,000 cookbooks, out of which only 200 are credited to African Americans. Okay? And African Americans played a very important role in cooking, but there was also had a disadvantage of literacy. Okay, and taking credit, just like in India, where I come from, 50% population is non-literate, and the non-literate population is mostly poor, and in fact, they do all the work of cooking, but their taste never registers, is never accredited. So you will see a lot of this missing stuff is what is foregrounded and what is backgrounded. For me, I'm just right now, in this particular case, foregrounding transnational immigrants. If you include domestic migration, you will have to also account for the migration of African Americans, especially from the south to the north, for instance, okay? And you see the data shows up in some interesting ways with Seoul and Southern and the constant relationship between what is the relationship between race and cuisine, between those two cuisine. But what did surprised me is that how well Seoul and Southern are doing at the high end of the market in bicoastal cities today, and it's also of course in New Orleans and also in Chicago. Almost 10% of Seoul restaurants are high-end restaurants in the Yelp data. So it's a fascinating thing of, as some things come into view, other things retreat from view. And your question specifically about the spatial organization of buildings, for instance, would be a lovely way to think about what is coming into view with this data and going out of view. Excellent question. Sorry I can't answer it.
Thank you for your talk. You just hit on what my question is, my big question I want to get to, a simpler question. Did you say that you're evaluating these restaurants based on how they identify themselves?
Absolutely.
Okay. So then, given what you were saying about the kind of disappearing of African-American contributions and that regionalism and also classism plays into this, I grew up in Georgia, so for me to make a distinction between Southern and soul food is a bit tricky. If I were wandering around a city and I wanted to feel like I was at home and I couldn't find anything that's called Southern, I would be happy to find a soul food restaurant.
Yes.
So is that possibly the distinction between Southern and soul? Does that suggest the Southern history with segregation?
Paul Friedman just wrote a book called American Cuisine and How It Came to Be. And one of the arguments he makes, in fact, is this question of the political segregation, in fact, creates identifications. And by the way, what I learned from his book is absolutely fascinating. The way Library of Congress classifies cookbooks, give you an example. If it is by a white author and it is about Southern cooking, it is classified under Southern with a different call number. If it is a cookbook written by an African-American author, it is classified, depending on the time period, as Soul or African-American or Negro. The call numbers are different, okay? Which is fascinating, which is partly an attempt to accommodate difference, but in the process of accommodating difference, it creates the segregation and a hierarchy, okay? So yes, and that is, it's a bit like, say, the Cajun Creole conversation if you go to Louisiana, which is also a bit an urban-rural discussion. Okay. When Jessica Harris writes about High on the Hog, she says she draws on two Southern traditions. Okay, and in some ways, she melds the two traditions. In fact, does not make a distinction between the two, other than saying that soul food at one point of time became a site of assertion of Black identity that had been denied. And then within the Black community, there was also a splintering. Remember, the Nation of Islam strongly disidentified with soul food as the food of enslavement. Okay? So that itself is a dynamic history of claims making and dialogic representation of, say in this case, soul, Southern, and race and white. And if you say Michael Twitty's most recent book is an argument about, called The Cooking Gene, is in fact making a claim for the Black presence in the Southern and not being trapped in the soul? Excellent question. I don't know whether my answer answers it, but.
Hello. Thank you, firstly, for your talk and also for making me crave jhalmuri. It's been a while since I've thought about it, and now I'm really.
You ask him what jhalmuri is. I said muri.
I make a mean jhalmuri, by the way, guys. So if you want some, ask me.
You got to make jhalmuri and feed it to everyone.
I will.
Describe it.
It's basically puff rice made mixed with a whole bunch of chilies and onions and stuff like that. And oil, so it's kind of unhealthy, but it's great street food. Frankly, you would die for some if you knew what it is, and I am dying for some right now.
And by when you say puffed rice, in Eastern India, the puffed rice is quite salty, not as sweet as the industrial puffed rice here. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask two questions. The first question I wanted to ask is, do you think fusion cuisine, as a native Bangladeshi myself, I've noticed a lot of fusion, especially anglicized fusion elements invading our type of cuisines, and I've wondered, does that shape the way we see the discourse and the identity of South Asian food? And the second question I want to ask is that if restaurants tend to self-brand their cuisines, I know that in London, a lot of Indian restaurants are actually Bangladeshi restaurants, so why do they hide underneath the banner of Indian restaurants if, especially in like London, when they have a great South Asian population, they can definitely identify under the banner of Bangladeshi?
Excellent question. The first one is about fusion. A couple of things about it. It is about self-naming and guessing about what the audience understands and knows. And in my book, I have one section called What's in a Name, okay? And so Muhammad Rasool, the example I started with, ethnographic example, Muhammad Rasool said he had named his restaurant Taj Mahal, and his restaurant wasn't working very well. One day he was commuting, and he fell asleep, dozed off, and the train stopped. He was jolted awake, and he realized he had to change the name of his restaurant, okay? And he changed the name to Salt and Pepper. I said, what? He said, because everyone knows Salt and Pepper. So I wanted to open up the possibility, okay? And I said, when I pushed him on it, he says, well, if I really want to name it correctly, I'll call it Pakistan or something, okay? But my problem is, when I say Pakistan, most Americans will think it's Afghanistan, okay? And there's a war going on there, and I don't have the time to explain to them that Pakistan and Afghanistan are different places, Okay? So I don't know how true this is, but this is a way of his thinking about how to come to this exchange and how to name it in a way in which that will attract him the widest audience. So India, because A, large size, imperial presence in South Asia, allows you to do a lot of things under the cover of calling it Indian. There are certain advantages to it, and the disadvantages, in some ways what he's complaining about, is the lack of geographic knowledge of Americans. And my theory is the more power you have, the less you need to know about geography. I grew up in India. I had to learn every damn city and river of every continent, everywhere in the world, right? And so, and of course, I have not retained anything, but at least I had to learn. The more powerful you are in some ways, you need to only know your own history and maybe your enemy's history, okay? And geography. So it's a funny thing about this thing about what to cover it with. And your secondary question about London. London is a very interesting case. I was looking for the data. I don't have it. I didn't send it in this. In London, Indian food is what Italian food is to Americans. That is what people go out to eat. Mostly is Indian food. So in popularity, it's the highest, okay? In prestige, it is much higher than here. But in London, there's also this thing where Indian is still the cover under which a lot of stuff is going on, okay? There's some niche attempts to create, and this is the link to the other question, sub-regional. I think we are not going to go to the national category as much. We're going to go to, in London, the biggest rage now is what is that group in Mumbai out of which all the industrialists come? The Parsi. Why did I forget Parsi? Parsi food. So Dishoom is the hottest restaurant in London, and it is totally in, like, say, kind of this very intense Parsi insider talk about it, and it references Parsi canteens in Mumbai. So I think what's going to happen is, like, right now it's all Indian in some generic sense of it, okay? And then the next level, I think, is going to be more regional. So you're going to get more Andhraite food. There's some difference like that in Tamilian food, especially tiffin, dosa, idli, vada, that are becoming ubiquitous. There's some recognition of Goa food, Goanese food, and the West Arabian seafood. But that is slowly emerging, and I think it hasn't even emerged in London. So United States, the Indian food market is about 20 years behind the London food market, Indian food in London market, you know? And by the way, the opposite true about Italian food in the U.S. U.S. has become an amazing place to get pretty good Italian food. Don't tell it to the Italians, okay? But everyone else takes it quite seriously in terms of Italian cuisine. Did I answer vaguely at least some of your questions? Other question, comment. Sorry, I was looking for the data. I didn't send it. Yep, ask your question.
So you kind of referenced it with talking about the Germans and the steep decline during the war. And I was wondering if any, like, if you think that the stereotypes that Americans have about a certain culture affect their prestige?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, and I think that stereotype is also often linked to class. Okay? And a good example is Chinese food. I mean, if you just think about it, if you really know anything about Chinese history, they probably had foodies long before anyone had foodies. Okay? And you can see them almost 1,000 years ago and an immense amount of writing that's going on. Just so happens to be, most of us don't know how to A, read that or know that history and can get away with it. So we associate Chinese food with cheap working class immigrant food, especially cooked by men who are not mostly historically trained to cook. It's a very different kind of food. By the way, that's also true about Indian food, okay? The best Indian food is still cooked at home. And especially there are cuisines where there's a big gap between home cooking and market cooking. That's also true, by the way, about lots of cuisine, especially also Italian. The French, in fact, got closest to, in fact, bridging that gap. It created a whole new genre. So yes, it is clearly linked to questions of class and race bias that's linked to it, and assumptions about culture, okay? And I would draw attention to a second thing that I think is important that did not come out in this argument so far, which is I think the civil rights movement plays a very important role in opening up our palates. Because, as we are learning, not everybody became anti-racist, but what happened is, basically, racism in some cosmopolitan urban contexts became burdened with a certain kind of an identity that is not high prestige. Okay? And so, but what the civil rights movement did was, in fact, provided a platform from what I would call cultural relativism. That, in fact, all cultures are interesting and equal and have refinement in their own ways if we are willing to learn about it and get close to it. That is something we learn from the general transformation of American culture that was associated with the civil rights movement. I think, of course, legally, by the way, remember, it opened up the country for people like me who could not, for instance, immigrate to the United States before the civil rights movement changed the laws, which is the 1965 immigration law. Second, it allowed a kind of an even-handedness towards culture. So what my talk is mostly about is, in spite of apparent equality, there is a hidden inequality of hierarchy. And of course, in some ways, if you read sociologists like Pierre Bourdieu, a lot of his work in distinction is about how does domination work in spite of democracy? That's what some of this is. Okay, is domination works in spite of democracy, where in fact some of the prejudices, and of course the interesting, remember, sub-thread of this story is, by the way, who is white? Just as black and brown is an unsettled category, white is a very unsettled category. Okay, Ben Franklin is complaining about the Germans as swarthy Teutonics. Okay, that is going to swamp the Anglo-white culture in the 18th century. And that is because that is a lot of Germans were not considered white. They become white. Irish become white through the course of the Civil War. Italians become white much later. Jews are just becoming white. Okay, and so that's an interesting history of, so color, as much as class, is socially constructed and produced in this dialogue, in this racial formation where some people climb and some people fall. And in this case, for instance, it's an interesting that's happening with the Asian population, because the racial transformation is going to transform the prestige of a lot of Asian cultures that we have already seen with Japanese culture. That's why the difference between Japanese and Chinese is basically where class is the carrier of bias rather than race. So each of these categories, if you kind of drill into them, you will find this interesting social historical moment. That is exactly why I show the German and the Italian data, to destabilize the easy assumptions that white, brown, black were all settled categories, and we knew from the very beginning who was white and who was brown and who was black. And based on that, we had respect or disrespected their culture. It turns out it's a more complicated story and a more interesting story, in fact.
Hi, thank you for your talk. You don't have to know the answer to this because it's probably outside your realm of research, but I was just wondering, while you were talking about class and involvement and certain societies and how they're viewed, how in the world did chai climb this, it's a beverage obviously, but like,
fascinating.
How is like Indian cuisine not regarded as that great of a thing, but chai has just And it's not chai tea. If anybody calls it chai tea, I would personally kill you. But yeah, how...
Excellent question.
Yeah.
I've thought about it. And part of it is this. Now I have to specify. My broad generalizations don't work anymore. And here is this. The Indian migration is a 70-30 migration, which is 70% of Indians coming into the United States have a bachelor's degree. So it is the migration with the highest kind of professional people, like, say, you and I, okay, who also, because we are from India, because we are colonized by the British, are also Anglophone, okay? So if you are Anglophone and if you have credentials in the modern world, like a degree that is transferable, you will do very well. And two things happens with that, okay? So 70% of Indians are coming from that group. 30% are coming from family reunification category, which is a much more unstable and a bit more working class category, okay? So all the cab drivers, Muhammad Rasool, are all family unification categories, okay? So those who are coming with degrees in Anglophonity are not starting restaurants because restaurant is a terrible business to make money. Okay, so we are getting jobs in large corporations, in universities, and in fact, we are doing most of the cooking and eating at home. Okay, so the kind of exposure you get to Indian food is poor Indian working class men's cooking, South Asian men's cooking, standing in for the Indian, okay, and in that class bifurcation, 70-30, okay, what's going to happen is some of the elements of Indian culture is acquiring sexiness. And most of my students are white. When they get married, all of them have a Bollywood dance sequence in their marriage, in the weddings now. Okay? And so that's acquiring a certain kind of cultural capital as it circulates. By the way, it has happened with Indian literature. Today, if you read English literature, you cannot be an expert in English literature unless you have read enough Indian writers. Okay, from Rushdie to Naipaul to the Indian diasporic literature. So in different fields, it has different registers, and chai tea is one of those things that has circulated in the world as kind of a borrowed, kind of a pastiche from a neighboring culture. Okay, it's a bit like, say, no different from General Tso's chicken. No different from, by the way, I don't have it. There's a beautiful quotation to this Italian guy who was walking around in New York City. He ate at an Italian restaurant, and this is in the 1920s, and he had spaghetti and meatballs. He says, wow, these Americans have invented a terrific thing, spaghetti and meatballs. We should go and tell the Italians back in Italy to also do spaghetti and meatballs, okay? And so there are always these kind of things that jump from one cultural community to the other and are appropriated in complicated ways. Forget about chai tea if you're pissed. Think about bubble tea now. That is the rage, okay? And that is linked to Taiwan. That is linked to specifically Taipei and a very urban, cosmopolitan, middle class, often student culture that is now circulating through every American college town. And New York, NYU neighborhood is filled with bubble tea spaces now. And bubble tea, think about it, is a fascinating thing. It takes tea and adds milk to it in a very, in some ways, a cold coffee kind of a format, and adds a very East Asian inflection to it, those chewy bubbles. One thing we're going to learn from the Chinese is texture that we haven't figured out yet. We like crisp. In the American context, we haven't figured out chewy yet, okay? And so chewy we're going to learn from the Chinese and from things like bubble tea, which you can say are kind of a bastardized global culture. They're little like foods of the way food would look like if food were like architecture and you were flying through the Dubai airport. The way global culture gets presented. A bit of this and a bit of that. Rushdie says that's how newness enters the world, and some of the times that newness is quite crappy. Some of the time it's quite interesting. And chai tea is exactly that.
We have time for one more question.
Back behind you.
Okay. I know in your book you mentioned culinary schools and like cooking schools. do like the fact that cooking schools focus on French cuisine influence what Americans believe as better food, or like if they influence more of African or Caribbean or even Indian cuisine, would that like make us perceive those type of food as more of a better, higher standard? Would that affect our views as like common people who don't go to cooking schools?
Absolutely. And part of it is it's about a shared repertoire within a closed, small, networked world, right? And the world of chef, when I joined the Culinary Institute of America, to give you an example, the Asian kitchen was called the Oriental kitchen. So I said, okay, I was just coming from university. I said, this is not going to work. Guys, we got to change the name of this thing, okay? Oriental was fine at some point, but it also has this thing about like domination written all over it. And the disruption had already happened on campuses, and it had kind of influenced other places, but had not reached culinary schools, because culinary schools were so far in some ways from the cultures of campuses, liberal arts campuses, okay? And so there was a very interesting series of discussions, how to do it, how to rename it, and then, of course, comes what to include in it. And the Oriental kitchen had basically 2 days of Chinese cooking, okay, taught by one faculty member, and was not regionalized at all. So slowly, over a 10-year period, we transformed that kitchen. We called it Asian kitchen, okay? But we could only add 2 more days of Indian cooking, 2 days of Japanese cooking, 1 day of Korean cooking, et cetera, et cetera. And my allies in that were the young chefs, white chefs, who were coming from California, who had worked in, say, the French Laundry, and had traveled in Vietnam and traveled in Thailand, and they had some sense of the range and multiplicity of what is Asian, so we could change a little. So for insiders, that was radical change. Okay, for a lot of the European chef, that was a disastrous change and slippery slope to including everyone in this thing called the canon. Okay, it is the making of the canon and the breaking of the canon and the remaking of the canon. And for instance, we never had, in some ways, any of the African cooking and the multiplicity of it. I'm just beginning to notice. New York Times, a couple of Wednesdays ago, had one whole special issue on Nigerian cooking. Okay, we are just beginning to get that. We had one on Filipino, because part of it is that I'm in the circle of people who are listening to, who have now read my book, and also listening to other people. And it has created a bit of a disruption, but not too much yet. Okay? And people are slowly kind of entering this kind of trying to transform. The San Francisco Chronicle, for the first time, has a non-white restaurant reviewer that is pissing people off like hell. And so some of that is changing, and it's a bit like how reviews are done in what networks. This is about networks and value, and how value is accrued in a network of judgment making. And by the way, no different from who gets the Nobel Prize in literature, okay? Most of the Nobel judges don't read most of the languages in the world. So how are they giving out Nobels, okay? And so it is a certain kind, and if you give it to one Portuguese once, you can bet the next day it's not going to be a Portuguese, okay? And so there's this kind of a, there's this, this is the decision in very small networks with forms of exclusion or even total unfamiliarity about it. Okay, and so that, of course, is exactly how domination works and marginalization works. And we can make little changes in some places, but it needs a big transformation in the racial formation to even make a dent in this. And people like, say, in the American genre of kind of gastronomic discourse, I think I started by thinking there's a relative underrepresentation, for instance, clearly of African foods, but also of African-American foods and commentary. I think that's changing with people like Twitty, with people like Jessica Harris. By the way, Netflix is going to make a whole movie on a series on High on the Hog with Jessica Harris. The Museum of Food and Drink in New York City is going to have a whole exclusive 1 year of it on African-American cuisines. So some of that is changing a bit, but also think about how long it took us to get an African-American museum amongst the Smithsonian network, right? It just happened, okay? So excellent point, and it's how institutions play a double role. Institutions congeal hierarchy and domination, but there's also always room in every institution to at least slightly disrupt it. Okay? And that's kind of the source of hope in an otherwise dominated world.
That concludes tonight's event. Please join me in thanking Professor Ray.